Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. It was only 2 weeks ago that many Americans sighed with relief, some rejoiced, over the murder conviction of Derek Chauvin. Chauvin is the former Minneapolis policeman found guilty of manslaughter and murder in the death of George Floyd, an unarmed black man. This week, Chauvin requested a new trial. In the meantime, North Carolina and the country as a whole have continued grappling with racial injustice, the much higher rates of violence and death by police against African Americans, and persistent but ineffective calls for reform. With me today to examine the problems of racial injustice in policing are Randy Shrewsbury, who is a former police officer, and he is executive director of the Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform. Randy, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Eric.
Thanks for being here. Also with us is Laura Pelliser from WUNC. She is a digital reporter. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, Eric.
And also here is John Rubin. He is professor of public law and government, director of the Public Defense Education Program, and he is part of a racial equity educational program, all at UNC Chapel Hill. Did I get that right, John?
You did. Thank you, Eric. Good morning, everybody.
It is with great relief that I got that title right. Okay. Thank you all for being here this morning. Let's start, Laura, with you. You have been covering one of the most closely watched police shootings since the Chauvin conviction, and that is the death of Andrew Brown Jr. in Elizabeth City the morning after the jury rendered their verdict. He was shot and killed by sheriff's deputies who arrived with search and arrest warrants. There's still a lot we don't know, but where do things stand now with the case of Andrew Brown Jr.?
Yes. So, So there is indeed a lot that we don't know, a lot of lingering questions at this point. So right now where things stand is family members and one lawyer designated by the family have seen a 20-second body camera video, a 20-second clip of a body camera video, I should specify. And they have been able to tell media and the public a little bit about what's in that view of the shooting. Elizabeth City, the city in which this all happened, the municipal government released the city camera footage from the incident, and we've been able to review it. I sat down with a family lawyer to be able to go frame by frame of that view of the shooting. At this point, there is an FBI civil rights investigation that is happening right now. There is also a State Bureau of Investigation probe, and that started almost immediately after the shooting. The State Bureau of Investigation stepped in. And as you know, Eric, a week ago, on Wednesday of last week, a Superior Court judge decided that the family could view the video within 10 days of the judge's ruling. And then the public will have to wait 30 to 45 days. The judge said that within minimum 30, maximum 45 days, the judge will be reviewing whether to release that footage to the family and to lawyers. At that point, it's expected that the tape would become public.
Now, John, you follow this closely in terms of how body cam footage is released, when it's released, who makes the decision. Give us a little context, if you don't mind, on how and why we do things in North Carolina and whether that is much different than what you would find in other states.
So I believe it was 2016, the North Carolina General Assembly passed a specific statute to deal with the release of body cam footage, because body cams, dash cams were becoming more prevalent. And there was not a specific law that dealt with it. As a result, body cam footage was treated as not a public record, and in fact, as a confidential personnel record in many parts of the state. So we have this statute now that says it's still not a public record, but it's not a confidential personnel record involving the officers. And the way people can get access to body cams is by applying to a court for an order releasing the footage. as I understand it, that is different than most states around the country. There is not this requirement of going to court to get an order. The type of order, there's two different kinds of disclosure. One is to the family to just view it, to see it, as Laura mentioned. And then the second type is release of a copy to either the family and or to the public. And I think there's been a little bit of confusion about what the judge ruled. As I heard him, he ruled that he would come back in 30 to 45 days to consider release of a copy to the family. But he outright denied the action by the media coalition for release to the media and therefore the public. I don't think there are any restrictions on what the family can do with what they see or with the copy they eventually obtain, if they do obtain it. But the judge did deny release to the media. Unless he changes his mind in his written ruling, which he hasn't issued yet, he did not allow that.
Randy, let me step back a little bit here. We have this case in North Carolina. You're in California. The AP reported that at least 6 police killings occurred within a day of the Chauvin verdict. None tied to the case. This was all separate situations. But certainly that shows how pervasive this problem has become. I'm wondering from your perspective, why do you think this particular incident in Pasquotank County, North Carolina, has resonated to the degree that it has?
Well, I think that it is largely because of the Chauvin trial, right? Because the topic of police violence or deadly use of force cases has been on everyone's mind, pretty heavily since George Floyd's death. But certainly there's been pivotal moments for which especially folks, who don't follow this day to day, it's been on, in conversations for which, may typically not have been. So, during the protest, of course, at the beginning of the trial, and then, of course, at the conclusion of the trial. And then we had 2 events, one there in North Carolina, and then the other one in Columbus, Ohio, that both sparked a great deal of attention and conversation. And it's one of the things that we talk about pretty regularly is that when we hear about these kind of high profile cases, of course, it's important to be able to highlight those, to examine those, to evaluate where can we do better to mitigate these kinds of events of occurring. But this is a daily incident or daily, series of events that are occurring across the country for which most of the cases get little to no attention at all. So, we remain concerned, as an example, now that the Chauvin trial has wrapped up, that that some of this attention will wane. And we're hopeful that when incidents such as these occur, that at minimum, it sparks a conversation for us to re-examine how we're dealing with public safety in America.
That's the voice of Randy Shrewsbury. He is a former police officer and executive director of the Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform. Also with us is Laura Pelliser from WUNC and John Rubin, who is professor of public law and government and director of the Public Defense Education Program at UNC Chapel Hill. Randy, we were talking before we came on the air, and one of the things that you said to me is, generally speaking, you don't like to weigh in a lot on cases while they're in process, because there are many things that we just simply don't know. But when you hear about something like Andrew Brown Jr. Dying after being shot by sheriff's deputies, what are some of the questions that first come to mind?
Well, I mean, I think that, there's some obvious issues about, his behavior, whether he was armed, and if he was armed, what was he armed with? If it was something that were the officers in an imminent danger One of the things that, you know, we examine pretty closely, you know, of course, is in training. And we have a concern that police officers are very often reacting, because it's how they're trained, reacting to what is possible instead of what is probable, or what's possible instead of what is imminent. And through training, you know, among other things, you know, this gives justification and legal cover very often for events for which we believe could be avoided. So I think, you know, in this particular case is that were the events leading up to his death, was this a response for which the officers were trained? And if so, was it reasonable? And if not, or even if it is considered legally reasonable, is there still ways that we can minimize these events from occurring in the future?
On Monday, the funeral for Andrew Brown Jr. was held in Elizabeth City. I want to play a portion of what Benjamin Crump, who is a family attorney and a prominent civil rights attorney, had to say.
Because Andrew cannot make the plea for due process, it is up to us to make the plea for due process. Because Andrew cannot make the plea for his constitutional rights, it is up to us to make the plea for his constitutional rights. And because District Attorney Womble, Andrew cannot make the plea for transparency, it is up to us to make the plea for transparency and demand that these videotapes be released.
Laura, you have been covering this throughout, and I'm curious, how, if at all, has the mood changed in Elizabeth City now that it's been 2 weeks? A lot of things have happened and a lot of things are in process. What's the tenor? What is it like in Elizabeth City now compared to the day after?
Right. Well, so when I first arrived in Elizabeth City, which was just a few days, maybe 3 days after the shooting first occurred, I would say on the ground, there was this deep sadness, this deep anger. And most of that anger at the beginning was directed to Sheriff Wooten, the Pasquotank County Sheriff. Since those first early days, Sheriff Wooten has sort of gone on the side of the city, you know, saying that, no, he also wants the tapes to come out, the footage to be released. And now sort of a lot of that anger has been redirected, as we heard there from Ben Crump, one of the family lawyers. A lot of that frustration has been redirected to District Attorney Womble. And there is a sense that that those tapes, the full tapes, can and should be released to the public, to the media. You know, that's what that hearing was about last week on Wednesday. And now sort of the sense on the ground, I think in the last few days when I sort of swapped out and my colleagues came in, was a sense of just being tired, of being sad. This is a community that is majority Black. This is a community, a lot of folks on the ground can speak very intimately to the overcriminalization of Black people in America. Folks have personal experiences, or family and friends have had negative encounters with law enforcement or negative encounters with the our prison system. And so I think there's a sense right now that people are tired as they wait for the next step. And that next step, as we mentioned earlier, is that, if I'm doing my math right, 10 days after that hearing means that by Saturday,
Laura, let me interrupt you. We're going to pick up that point. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We'll be right back.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we are continuing our conversation about policing and police reform. My guests today are John Rubin, he is professor of public law and government at UNC Chapel Hill, Randy Shrewsbury of the Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform, and Laura Pelliser of WUNC, who I interrupted there. Laura, go ahead and continue your thought. I apologize.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, the feeling on the ground that I'm hearing about right now is that people are tired, people are sad, and essentially it's a waiting game because you gave me a chance to do some math on that. So the hearing from the judge was last Wednesday. He said that, you know, within 10 days, he would be allowing the family to disclose to the family more of the body camera footage. And so that means that by Saturday, we should be hearing, we may be hearing more directly from the family lawyer about the contents of some of that body camera footage.
John, help us sort out a couple of things here. When we think about this footage, the Reverend Al Sharpton, I believe at the service the other day, made a comment to the effect of whatever's on those tapes is not going to change between seeing them now or seeing them in 30 days or 45 days. The judge who made the decision cited several reasons. Among them, he was concerned about the risk to having impartial justice. He was also concerned about the safety of people involved in this. How do you begin to sort this out in terms of what is the best approach to satisfy the public's knowledge and to also meet those other standards that the judge and others are talking about?
Our statute lists several factors that a judge must consider in deciding whether to release body cam footage. One is whether there's a compelling public interest in release, and the judge did find there was a compelling public interest. But then there are other factors listed in the statute, such as interference with an ongoing criminal investigation, potential harm to people who are pictured in the video. And the judge found that those factors outweighed the public's interest. Now, if you want to jump in, I don't want
to. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Some states, including some states have already adopted legislation, and North Carolina is considering legislation to change that approach. So there is one bill pending that would require disclosure, release within 48 hours, unless law enforcement got a judge to hold back the footage. So that's one approach. There's another bill in North Carolina, and this is an approach in other states, that treat critical incidents differently than ordinary interactions with police. And a critical incident would be one where essentially deadly force has been used. And it says the public has a greater interest in knowing. As one resident put it, you know, I can lapse into this kind of formal legal talk. As one resident put it, what's the point of having body cams if we can't see them, if it's still a closed decision-making process? So some states and a bill that's been introduced would require disclosure for critical incidents. The Governor's Task Force on Racial Equity and Criminal Justice System has also recommended that approach. Now, it does set a 45-day time limit for disclosure, and in light of what's happened in the Andrew Brown killing, people may want to reconsider whether a 45-day wait is really an appropriate amount of time. The judge was concerned about releasing the video, interfering with the administration of justice. But on the other hand, there is confidence and trust in the administration of justice, which is potentially undermined by withholding critical incident footage for such a long period of time.
Randy, I want to ask you, because a lot of the work you do obviously is around how police are taught to react and trying to improve in areas where they need improvement. Now, we mentioned earlier, there are so many things we don't know about this case yet. But some of the early things that have been said, particularly on the family side, involve their statements that Andrew Brown Jr. was in his car. He was not. He was not armed. He was not threatening anyone. The prosecutor, I believe, has said that the car made contact with some of the deputies. So again, there are a lot of things that we don't know. But this basic idea of when someone flees, and we've had a number of cases separate from this one where someone is fleeing, they're not armed, they're not, in a violent situation, and the police will not only pursue, but at times use deadly force. Here's my very layman's question. Why not in those circumstances, why not let the person go and pick them up later? What is the thinking and training, never let anyone get away? Or just give me a little perspective on that.
Well, your layman's question is my professional question. Because I think it's a good question that we need to pose. So, when we look at training, one of the problems that we face with training, just to back up just a little bit, is that it's very fragmented. So with training, you know, what the officers may have received in, one municipality can be very, very different for which an officer receives in another. There's 18,000 police departments in the United States, not 18,000 different training academies, but each of those 18,000 have provided, additional training like continued education or field training. So one problem that we have is that there is this kind of lack of universal guidance about how to react in these kinds of circumstances. My position is this, is that all too often, whether it is, a deadly use of force incident where they're, shooting folks, or if it's just a pursuit, that these are situations for which can be that escalation can be avoided, right? By handling things more from an administrative standpoint. It was always very baffling to me as a police officer when we would be engaging in, pursuits of folks when we already had their information, right? We already knew who they were. Now, are there, for the Professor Rubin will be impressed, are there exigent circumstances for which, perhaps an officer needs to be, to react or engage in a pursuit or use deadly use of force if there is an intention by the driver to run over officers or bystanders? Of course, that's we're not saying that an officer should just inherently remain in harm's way, but at the same time, what we see, especially with these moving vehicle cases, and I don't know if it's the case with Mr. Brown, but is very often we're seeing officers placing themselves in positions of danger by not retreating or not taking tactical efforts to get out of the way. If the person gets away, there'll be another day for which you can make the arrest. So we hope that much of this is a direct result of training. So we're hoping that that there becomes this greater emphasis about recognizing when you can retreat and when that retreat doesn't add a public safety issue, and to recognize when their actions shooting at someone behind the wheel, you now have a 3,500 pound bullet that's could be hitting innocent bystanders or going down the road. So we just think that with good training, officers will have an opportunity to be able to evaluate more on a case-by-case basis instead of these blanket responses to kind of a one size fit all that just clearly doesn't work.
Eric, John, if I could jump in, yes. Your lay understanding, Randy's practical approach aligns with the legal limits on the use of deadly force. There are constitutional limits on when an officer may use deadly force, and it cannot just be merely when somebody disobeys a command. North Carolina has a specific statute that implements those constitutional limits, that when somebody's fleeing, an officer can use deadly force when that person is posing a deadly threat, and merely leaving the scene may not pose that.
John, I wanted to ask you are involved with this racial equity education program. at UNC Chapel Hill, and I believe you're a consultant to the governor's racial equity task force that is working on criminal justice reform as well. All of us on this program and 99% of the people listening to this program know that this is something that is very difficult to solve, or we wouldn't be talking about it all the time. But what's your sense of possibility in making gains, incremental gains or significant gains, based on what you're seeing, for example, with what the governor is trying to do?
There are several recommendations in the report. They fall into two basic categories. One is involving policing, and the other is involving the courts. You know, as far as policing, you can group them into several categories. I made some notes about them. One is on the use of force, that there be more emphasis on de-escalation and the use of the minimum amount of force required. Also restrictions on chokeholds. There's also some measures recommended to change law enforcement priorities, de-emphasize investigating or arresting for drug possession, limiting traffic stops for regulatory violations, which can often be a pretext for further investigation and can also result in unnecessary conflict and the use of force. I don't know the exact circumstances of it, but Dante Wright, who was killed outside Minnesota, was stopped for an expired tag, and then the matter escalated. So that might be a regulatory matter, traffic matter, that could be handled a different way than an officer-citizen interaction that could go bad. More on body cams, more on diversity and anti-discrimination and training, and more on getting the right person for the right kind of call, that an armed officer may not be appropriate for all circumstances, people with different kinds of training, you know, mental health, social services, workers may be the better people to respond to some kind of calls. These are reform efforts, some have been introduced in the legislature, and we'll see what happens. And some of them are a matter of local policy, local departmental policy.
That is the voice of John Rubin. He is a professor of public law and government at UNC Chapel Hill. Also with us is Randy Shrewsbury, who is a former police officer and executive director of the Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform, and Laura Pelliser from WUNC. She is a digital reporter. Laura, I want to ask you, you know, it's one thing for us to speak of this reform and the problems we have in somewhat of a clinical manner, trying to pull all of this information together. But you are watching this impact firsthand. You're seeing the people that are affected on all sides of this. What's your sense of the toll this is taking on people who are directly involved in this, whether it's the family, law enforcement, the justice system? What do you sense?
Well, from my experience on the ground, I'm speaking with residents, speaking with activists, speaking with the family. Honestly, the word that comes to mind is trauma. You know, we're asking a lot of this family to keep essentially reliving and retelling this 20-second video, this 20-second clip. We're depending on them and the family lawyer to tell the public and to tell the media what they saw in that clip, because there's so little information that is available. And they're reliving the trauma of seeing a family member shot and killed. And something that also comes to mind, if I can just pivot back for a second, is this question of a Black man fleeing from officers. When some of the folks that we heard from on the ground said, at this point, of course you're gonna flee. You know, what choice do you have? I heard from residents who said that he was fleeing for his life. And there's a lot that we don't know about the circumstances. We really don't know what happened right before the shooting. We're missing so much video. But there is a sense from folks on the ground that they're out of options. You know, if you are a Black individual in America and the police are are stopping you for a traffic stop, are executing a search and arrest warrant. You know, there are folks who say when you comply, it goes wrong. When you flee, it goes wrong. When you know, what are the options left for Black Americans? And so those are some of the things that I've been thinking about as this story unfolds.
John, we know that Andrew Brown Jr. had been convicted on felony drug charges. He had a number of legal run-ins, for, you know, lack of a better description. Should that matter at all when you get into a situation that, as Randy says, potentially is one where there's not a threat of, you know, if he's not armed, he's not threatening. Help me sort of sort that out in terms of the mindset of the police officer and how they approach that.
Well, I can speak a little bit to the law, and then I think Randy would be a good person to talk about how an officer might take those things into account. You know, generally, we look at what a reasonable officer would consider in deciding to use force, including deadly force. And one factor, one thing they might consider is the person's past and past encounters. So I don't know exactly what the drug matters were. I don't know exactly what these prior incidents were with officers. I understand they were cases involving resist, delay, and obstruct. That's a crime in North Carolina. But resist, delay, and obstruct can be lots of different things. It can be something violent, or I think that was actually alleged that George Floyd, by refusing to get into the car, was resisting, delaying, and obstructing. So it is a wide range of behavior. So sure, officers can take into account the prior encounters with the person in how they approach the situation. But then, of course, the most important thing is going to be, what was the behavior at the time? What behavior were they seeing that made them decide to use force?
Let me cut you off right there. And Randy, I'm going to let you pick this up right after we take a break. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We're continuing our conversation about policing and police reform. And with me today is Laura Pelliser. She is a digital reporter at WUNC. Also here, Professor John Rubin. He is professor of public law and government at UNC Chapel Hill and director of the Public Defense Education Program. And Randy Shrewsbury, who is a former police officer and executive director of the Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform. Randy, I kind of misguided the question there a little bit. Professor Rubin saved me from myself and gave us the legal context. From an officer's perspective, what is the officer thinking about in terms of a suspect's record and how that factors into what they do next? And as part of that, what should they be thinking about in that context?
Well, I think that, you know, if we're looking at similarities to this case, and so, you know, police officers are executing a warrant for which, you know, a person may have had some indication of either resisting arrest or, you know, assaulting an officer, which assaulting, I don't believe, you know, is an issue with Mr. Brown. But to you know, Professor Rubin's point is that, you know, resisting is a very, very broad term. It could just mean that they ran, right? In some jurisdictions, that's considered resisting. So there isn't one, you know, one size that fits all relative to that term. But of course, it would be logical for officers to consider if somebody, you know, has been violent in the past or have had a violent response when there's been an attempt to arrest them, or even if they have a history of fleeing, right? There's a tactical approach for which an officer, you know, may need to consider if, you know, it's someone who runs, you know, every time that that they have a police encounter. I don't disagree with Laura's point, you know, of where, you know, we have to start looking at that, you know, individuals, especially individuals of color, that, you know, their choices to flee or to have, you know, to not just immediately comply, there's a lot more psychology to this than just not wanting to go to jail, or just wanting to be defiant to the police. Now, what I will say, and I'd like to kind of just back up a little bit mm-hmm. to what Professor Rubin had said, is that, you know, where I think that we could do best, and of course, you know, we focus on training, so we think that there's a lot of training areas that we can improve upon. But the major thing that I think that we can do is reduce the footprint of policing in the United States, reduce the responsibilities for which we've placed on police officers, that will then reduce the interactions. And the Dante Wright case, is a perfect example for which that traffic stop could have been handled or that violation could have been handled administratively. There didn't need to be three armed individuals that were dealing with somebody whose registration had expired in the middle of a pandemic, by the way. But as we add more and more, or as we have as a society, if we've added more and more to the police for which, you know, for them to deal with problems in our society, ranging from poverty to mental health to drug addiction, for which they are not adequately trained or equipped to be able to deal with, we're going to continue to see these situations. The other thing is that, and one of the things that especially bother me about Mr. Brown's death is that this is another result of our failed policy on the war on drugs. You know, we've been doing this a long time, 40 years. It hasn't worked. It's not going to work, right? We cannot jail our way out of this problem. And if legislators are not stepping up to deprioritize or to take a different approach, then we hope that there becomes the emphasis on this in training, as well as in policies in police departments, that there are better things for the police to be doing than just continuing a failed policy.
Speaking of legislators, John, I want to ask you a little bit about, as we look at the national picture, last week, President Biden called on Senate Republicans to support the George Floyd Justice and Policy Act. It was passed by the House in March. And one of the central debates in this act is the idea of qualified immunity. People like me in the media tend to throw terms like that around without perhaps fully grasping all of the meaning of that. So what is qualified immunity and why is it such a sticking point?
Eric, that's my understanding, is that that is the big sticking point. The George Floyd Justice and Policing Act would eliminate qualified immunity, which is a doctrine that was created by the U.S. Supreme Court. It's not something that exists otherwise. So it essentially creates a hurdle to consideration of the question of whether an officer needed to use deadly force. That's the ultimate question, is whether the officer should have used deadly force in that situation. Qualified immunity is an initial hurdle that somebody needs to get over, and they need to establish that the officer violated a clearly established statutory or constitutional right of which a reasonable person would have known. A judge would ordinarily decide that. And if he decides, he or she decides that there is not a violation of that long phrase I just gave you, then the case goes away. The case is dismissed and it does not go to trial.
Randy, I want to ask you, you have written about and spoken many times about how when you were a policeman, you considered yourself a privileged racist cop. You have spoken bluntly about what the conversations are like among police officers sometimes. How do we, first of all, it's always dangerous to generalize about such a large group of people. But in terms of this particular problem, how do we begin to undo the aspects that are leading to this problem again and again?
Well, to what I mentioned earlier, a lot of this is driven by policy, unfortunately, and in policing priorities. You know, one of the things I always say is that, you know, I talk about, and you know, the op-ed that you had referred to, you know, I talked about, you know, I had a complicity through my silence when I saw, you know, racist behavior, especially just outward racist behavior among police officers. But I don't believe that most police officers are racist, but I do believe that they're asked to do racist things. And you know, the war on drugs is a really perfect example of that, right? Where, you know, drug use and drug dealing is largely equal against all racial groups, but people of color are overwhelmingly more likely to be targets of investigations or arrest, get heavier prosecution, heavier jail sentences, those kinds of things. So I think the very first thing, as cliche as this may sound, is that there needs to be an honest reckoning inside of policing in of itself to say what we are doing disproportionately impacts one community over another. From there is that there are things that we need to explore about seeing if we can measure particular biases in the hiring process, or doing strong background investigations that may include social media posts or affiliations. The FBI has been warning for years about the infiltration of white supremacy groups inside of law enforcement. I mean, I think this has been going back now 20 years, and every couple of years they put out a new, you know, screaming alert saying that, you know, this is an issue. I think that we also have to understand that when we look at some of the solutions that we propose today, is we look at very, very simple solutions for very, very complex problems. So as an example, one of the things we hear about pretty regularly is for police officers to receive implicit bias training. And don't get me wrong, I think it is important for any of us to be able to recognize a particular bias that we may have through training. However, these trainings are incredibly brief. They're usually a day long. We really don't know that they're effective. In fact, the early data is pointing that they're not. It isn't to say that expanding that training could improve its efficacy, but a simple solution of let's just do an implicit bias training, and then that becomes the magic wand to you know, get rid of you know, racial inequities, that it is not going to work. And then finally is a reprioritization about what the police are spending their time on. If police officers are spending time, you know, dealing with things like the war on drugs or pretextual stops, like Professor Rubin talked about earlier, stop and frisk. These are all things that, number one, will impact one community or another, and it will continue to divide.
John, I think you had some thoughts about the immunity question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I may have jumped in with too much technical information. So let me just back up. Qualified immunity is something that is brought up in a civil suit against a law enforcement officer. It's not something that would apply in a criminal prosecution, would not be a defense. But pursuing criminal prosecutions, there's a whole other set of issues about pursuing criminal prosecutions against officers. One of the things that's being proposed in North Carolina is that when there's this kind of situation, like with the Andrew Brown killing, that a special prosecutor from the Attorney General's office be brought in. Right now, it is up to the local DA to decide whether to ask for that. And in this case, the local DA has not asked.
That's the voice of Professor John Rubin from UNC Chapel Hill. He specializes in public law and government. Also with us is Randy Shrewsbury, who is from the Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform, and Laura Pelliser of WUNC. I'm sorry. Laura is a digital reporter there. Laura, I want to ask you, you mentioned at the beginning of the show that Elizabeth City is a majority African-American city. The county, Pasquotank County, is majority white, I believe. How much of a, is this boiling down to a racial matter in terms of who's on which side? Is it more nuanced than that? What are you seeing and hearing?
You know, that's a really tricky question, because I'm certainly seeing a lot of media reports that are essentially creating this divide, that are saying that you've got a majority white county, you've got a white sheriff, we have a white district attorney in Andrew Womble. It was a white judge who made the decision at the hearing last Wednesday. And you do have a majority Black community in Elizabeth City. And of note, the mayor of Elizabeth City is Black, the city manager, the chief of police is Black. So I think it's easy to say that, that this is, that they are attacking, that city residents are attacking the county because of that whiteness. And it's just hard to say how much, race at the upper levels is playing a role. But I am certainly seeing from activists on the ground and from residents who are saying that they need to break up, what they're calling the good old boys club of a white judicial system. And white judges who some residents believe are acting with bias in their decision-making. Now, I can't speak directly to whether, race is, these implicit biases are an issue at this upper level, but it is certainly part of the conversation. And it's something that we have to ask ourselves, especially as we move forward and we're able to get a bit of distance and take a step back and look at the bigger context in which this story is happening, and about sort of the historical legacy of the judicial system in North Carolina and who it has served historically.
And Laura, in terms of the, the approach of police, their tactics, their equipment, how does that factor into this and other cases like this that come under so much scrutiny?
Well, this is an interesting thing that, once again, I think we need a whole other show to talk about this question.
I was going to say, you've got all of 30 seconds, but yeah, do your best.
Thank you for that, Eric. the question of the over-militarization of police in America is a big one. And I'm sure it's one that, Randy is thinking about deeply and John is thinking about as well. And we did see in this case from the Elizabeth City street video, we saw, a SWAT team and in SWAT style equipment, trying to carry out these are search and arrest warrants. And we do have the lawyer, a family lawyer, Chantel Cherry Lassiter, who said that there were assault style weapons in use. Now, I have watched the video myself of that street footage, and I could not confirm to you whether those weapons are assault style weapons or not. It was just hard for me to determine, but that is the allegation that we're hearing. That is what we're hearing from lawyers.
I'm going to have to let you have the last word there. We'll have more to discuss with this, I'm sure, in the future. I want to thank all three of you, Laura Pelliser, Randy Shrewsbury, and John Rubin. Thank you so much for the hour. I'm Eric Sandberg, in for Mike Collins.
Thank you.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.